This podcast is rated S for science and also for spoilers and swearing. There's going to be swearing.
No! It can camouflage!
Something is killing these people and sucking them dry.
Run! It's a stampede!
There's something out there waiting for us.
Welcome everybody to Cinematica Animalia, the podcast where we break down the biology of movie monsters. This week we'll be touching on 1987's Predator, talking about facial appendages, incredible jumping ability, and phosphorescent green blood. I'm Dr. Adam Hasek. I'm a disease ecologist at the University of Arkansas, soon to be at the Ben-Gurion University of the Negev in southern Israel. Joining me is the Baroness, Libby Young, our story specialist and writer at Short Story Soup. Sam is on assignment, fending off the trolls again, I think trying to teach them how to draw, maybe using some crayons. Eventually they'll get some sharper objects like pencils, but we don't quite trust them yet. And with us, as always, is Dave, our movie physiologist.
Woo!
So, as far as news goes, we've got, again, plenty of bad stuff, but Dave, I think you had some good news with Biochar?
Is that a Pokemon? Is that a new Pokemon?
I'm pretty sure Biochar is a Pokemon.
Yeah, so, I mean, trying to find happy news these days, which, as discussed, seems to be getting harder and harder. There's been a lot of attention lately paid to a certain substance called biochar.
Which is a new Pokemon.
So biochar is the product of heating biomass, such as wood chips, animal manure, sludges, compost, and green waste, in an oxygen-starved environment, a process called pyrolysis, that basically results in this stable charcoal that, if mixed properly, can be used to try and pull in carbon from basically external sources. They're playing around with different ways that they can use it to basically draw down carbon from the atmosphere into the soil and potentially store it for hundreds of thousands of years. It also seems to reduce nitrogen output, and it has major benefits for the plants that it's used in. So there is a campaign going on from a couple of different groups right now to start looking into the ways that this can be used to basically try and respond to a lot of different bioenvironmental hazards, ranging from nitrogen depletion to acidity in sandy soils, where it can basically be used as a fertilizer. So creating sort of multiple benefits to try and help with crop yield, as well as being environmentally and economically viable.
So you're using this with sludge, trash, wood chips.
Yep.
All the stuff you can just break down. Do you know if you can use any Grimer or Muk?
I do not know.
Those are Pokemon. Does it make you... Any news on, like, if it makes people start, like, coughing or wheezing?
Those are also Pokemon. Okay, so we're Pokemoning now.
Yeah, that's all I got. Perfect answer, though, for the Who's That Pokemon sounds thing.
Who's That Pokemon?
I also had some somewhat happy news that China will plan to plant 36,000 square kilometers of new forest a year until 2025.
Nice.
Trees are not the answer, but they're definitely part of the solution. That's awesome.
It's close to 150,000 square kilometers of trees, which I'm all about.
And in bad news, but I'm going to read it like it's happy because I'm tired of being sad all the time, Biden is going forward with Trump's plans to revoke the gray wolves as endangered species.
Fuck.
So bye-bye protection.
So much of a need to do that.
Hello, fucking hunters. Idiots.
God.
Well,
speaking of hunters.
Got him.
Libby, do you want to give us a summary of this movie that we're going to be talking about today?
Well, sure. Predator, which was almost called Hunters, by the way, fun trivia fact.
Mm, cool.
Is about a group of U.S. soldiers. Inexplicably, one of them is Austrian, and they don't explain why. but it's about a group of U.S. soldiers that... get dropped into Guatemala to rescue a group of what they assume are hostages. I think they're supposed to be politicians. They land, and after finding a bunch of dead U.S. soldiers that they did not know were supposed to be there, and when I say dead, I mean gutted, skinned, disemboweled.
Hung from a tree.
Yeah. They discover that they are being hunted by...
Kevin Peter Hall.
Yes. Not a predator. Kevin Peter Hall.
In a suit that looks like a predator. It's a fun, a very common misunderstanding about this movie.
Yes. They discover that they're being hunted. The jungle is coming alive and killing them one by one. So It is a flight to abandon their mission and just get the fuck out.
Another way to say that would be, get to the chopper!
Get to the chopper!
So many times during this movie, those classic lines come up, and I turn to Libby, like, he said the line. He said the line.
He did the, when they do the Carl Weathers and the Arnold Schwarzenegger do
oh,
the hand
so good.
Thing. He goes, here comes the meme.
It's coming. It's fucking coming. Yes! Those big, beautiful, beefy biceps.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
So, what do we like about this movie?
So, all cards on the table. My dad was a giant Predator and Alien fan and just used to put these movies on repeat for my little brother and I over and over and over again. At ages that looking back on it might not have been completely appropriate. I've seen this movie more times than I can count. I love the setting. I love the creature. And I love a story that just is nice and small. Like, it just centers on one group. They're not trying to save the world. The alien is not a big threat to, like, humanity. It's just trying to fucking kill them. And it's a group of Marines just being like, no, we're stronger than you, alien dick.
And then they're not.
They're factually, categorically not.
One of them is?
Well, he outsmarts it. He's not stronger.
Fair enough. I love everything about this movie.
Yeah, same. This is a movie that I was telling Libby about, a friend of mine, Hayden Blue, if you're a listener out there. Hey, how's it going? I would go over to his house a lot in middle and high school and just watch these movies. Predator, Predator 2, the Alien movies, some Terminator, but Alien, the Xenomorph movies, and the Predators were something we were right into. He was more the Alien fan, I was more the Predator fan. And it's just one of those really solid, fun, action monster movies that's just straight up, here it is. Here's your situation. Like Dave said, there's no world-ending consequences. Just you versus this monster. Good fucking luck.
Yeah, so I grew up, I wasn't allowed to watch this movie, but for some reason I was allowed to watch Alien. My mom was very all over the place with what I was allowed to watch. So I grew up loving Alien. I thought it was absolutely phenomenal. And I didn't get to see Predator till I was in high school. And it was a lot different than I expected. I don't know. I think for me, I expected it to be, because, you know, you hear those two movies in synonymous with each other so much. Mm-hmm. I think I expected it to be more horror. And when it wasn't, I was not necessarily disappointed. I thought it was a really fun take on having this alien, having this kind of horrific looking creature, but it's just a straight almost action flick, which was really cool. So I had a lot of fun watching it.
Yeah, as far as things we didn't like, I think the only thing for me is some of the language is dated. Beyond that, I don't really have too many problems with this movie.
Yeah, my one complaint about this movie is that Carl Weathers is not shirtless enough, and I'm absolutely sexually objectifying him right now, and I do not give a fuck.
I agree with Libby.
Sorry, Carl Weathers, you're a good human being, I think, but
and a great actor.
You had a very, very nice body.
Yep. Yeah, I mean, it's got to say something about the Predator's intelligence that the first thing it does is it shoots off one of Carl Weathers' big, beefy biceps. It just decides it's got to take that weapon out of the equation. I don't really have anything I don't like about this movie. It's one of those rare ones that I found has, like, aged fairly well.
Agreed.
Just because I don't find that also it has to deal with any of, like, the societal problems that might have been present at that point, because it's literally just, like, group of soldiers in the jungle fighting people, and I'm like, that's still going on today.
Yeah. I think one of the things, like, less of a problem, more it's like an interesting little tidbit that I've always found about this movie is, at least in the US, I can't speak for every other place, but I'm guessing it's going to be fairly similar, that this is a very, quote, male movie. A lot of young dudes like this movie. It's very testosterone-fueled, very military, very ooh-rah. But it's a movie full of big, beefy men who are all greased up, very shirtless, very, not touchy, but there's a lot of, like, admiring each other and, you know, being very flexy and strong.
Camaraderie.
A lot of camaraderie. And I just find that very interesting, that all of this homoerotic energy is just full. This is loaded into this testosterone-fueled manfest. Sorry, Beefcake Village is what this movie should be called.
I mean, even the Predator, he's pretty beefcakey.
He's a beefy boy.
Them quads look good, boy. Mm.
Allow us to walk you through gay leg day bay soiree.
Also available for hetero leg day bay.
Moving into trivia. So, Libby, you already shared with us a little bit of trivia that this movie was supposed to be called Hunter. Does anybody else have some fun trivia about this movie? If not, I have a bunch.
Yes.
I do. So does Libby.
So, the start of this movie, following the release of Rocky IV, there was a joke that circulated in Hollywood that Rocky had run out of earthly opponents to fight. So, the screenwriters, so they said that he would have to fight an alien if a fifth Rocky were to be made. So, the screenwriters, Jim and John Thomas, took inspiration from this joke and wrote the screenplay based on it. Yeah.
I had never heard this.
Yep, and Thomas' script for Predator was originally titled Hunter. And then my last bit of trivia was, speaking of Carl Weathers, he claimed that all the cast used to sneak waking up at 3 a.m. to go secretly work out, but they would try to work out away from each other, and Carl Weathers would always make sure that no one could see him working out, so that way he could walk around set and claim that his body was just like just that way. That he didn't get it from working out.
That's hilarious.
Isn't that great?
The just building on your screenplay idea, Shane Black, who plays Hawkins in the movie,
mm-hmm.
had apparently previously been written, had written the screenplay for Lethal Weapon. So he was actually covertly cast in a role so that he would be available to make on-the-fly, uncredited script changes while on the set. Because they didn't have any more budget for like further writers while they were out there. So they're like, cool, we'll just hire an actor who's okay. He's
also
not great.
A writer.
Right. And then he can just do shit and we'll kill him off whenever we want.
Now I'm wondering, did he write all those terrible pussy jokes or was that somebody else? Because his character really, really hung on to those.
I really don't love Shane Black. He's also wrote and directed The Predator. So
the worst one ever made.
Yeah.
Yeah, real bad. I think my bit of trivia is, originally, Kevin Peter Hall is a gentleman who, as Libby told me, is 7'2", well over 2 meters tall, very large gentleman, played the Predator. But originally, it was supposed to be Jean-Claude Van Damme, the muscles from Brussels, all 5'9" of himself. But he was a bit of a pain to work with. The suit they originally had for the Predator, which is a lot more insect and ant-like than it was this amazingly unique Yautja, as they're called in the literature, mm-hmm. This Predator look, they kind of decided to get rid of him and replace him with a much larger, much more imposing, because, as Libby told me before we started recording, next to all these other big, beefy, you know, greased up, testosterone-fueled, beautiful beefcakes, Jean-Claude Van Damme looked kind of puny, not as intimidating, even though he is, I think, a very fit, you know, dude.
Yeah, they originally hired him because he was lithe and could do all these acrobatic stunts.
That's right.
But it's fun. It's fun because you can actually Google this and see pictures of him in the original Predator suit.
Yep, it looks fucking ridiculous.
Yeah, it's almost as good as seeing the picture of Kevin Peter Hall in the suit with his little face poking out,
smiling.
Yeah,
you can just see the top half of his smile because the way the suit cuts it off, he looks very happy. He's a good sport.
My last trivia, or two trivias, just have to do with the miracles of filmmaking and when you're like, fuck it, we'll make it work. So the filmmakers attempted to use a heat vision camera for the Predator, but apparently it wasn't practical for them to use to shoot on location. So instead, they just took the normal footage and made it into a negative image in post-production and then gave sort of those like heat line effects. And then the other was apparently they were all set to make orange blood for the Predator, but it just looked awful whenever they tried to like spoof it up with special effects, and the orange goop looked so bad on camera they decided fuck it and ended up just breaking a bunch of glow sticks that they had that were available. They got them over the counter apparently from a local store and then were like, cool, the blood's green now.
It's really interesting how that like that little decision just changes the entire lore of this universe.
Mm-hmm. Right? Where it's like $10 at your local Stop and Gas puts you into a position where you're like, cool, it green now.
It's a fun little parallel, though, because the Predator's got, you know, that phosphorescent green blood, and then the Aliens is also not quite as phosphorescent, but also green and acidic. One bit of trivia that I noticed watching this movie that I haven't really noticed before, there's a scene where Carl Weathers has a scorpion on his back, and Mac, Bill Duke's character, tells him to turn around, pulls out a knife, and stabs at him very menacingly, and Carl Weathers turns around and sees that it's just a scorpion, which is a desert fucking species in the middle of this Guatemalan jungle? No, I don't think so.
Maybe it's stowed away in his boot. They did mention they were in Afghanistan.
They did, but Carl Weathers wasn't with them. I'm calling bullshit.
If alligators can swim across the sea, you're saying that a scorpion could have secretly found itself into the rainforest?
Technically, yes. I mean, that's how cane toads got to Australia. They were hiding in trucks, so you never know.
They were hiding in army boots.
They were hiding in Carl Weathers' comically small business suit with a tie.
What is this fucking tie business?
Oh, come on. Forget about my tie, man.
Before we move into the science, just before, remember that you can reach out to us. Sam and I can be found on Twitter. Sam is at Big Dr. Fishboy. I'm at Hasek Adam. If you want to reach out to the pod, it's cinematica.animalia@gmail.com. If you want to see this at the website, cinematicaanimalia.com. If you want to see some of the short stories that Libby writes and some more of her writing away from the podcast, shortstorysoup.substack.com. And if you want to see the more hardcore science that Sam and I write about, it's ecologyforthemasses.com.
Now you have to say that like Arnold.
Now, if you want to get to the chopper, you have to go to the chopper!
That was actually really good.
Put down the cookie!
Put down the cookie! It's not a tumor!
There's kindergartners running around the Guatemalan jungle.
Be a pretty good movie.
So for my science sections this week, I'm hoping to just kind of bring you guys in back and forth to kind of talk about, because I think all of these topics are pretty basic, and I don't actually have any strong concerns with them. I just think that the science around them is kind of interesting.
Same.
Reading through, and I'm sure that every fan would want us to touch on it, because I would definitely want to touch on it. The predators have the coolest fucking face.
That old crab vagina face.
Yeah. The mandibles opening up with the sort of secondary spikes that look to sort of pull things in. They've got what is referred to as arthropod-like mandibles with no visible nose, and the biological purpose really hasn't ever been discussed. For their faces, there's been a whole bunch of different theories with the fans, which, God, I love, talking about how the mandibles apparently flare and they seem to convey emotions.
Mm-hmm.
So flared mandibles signify anger, so you see him when he gets all mad that he's fighting Arnold, or surprise. They can click together to signify interest or curiosity. And they seem to grin with them as well, which we get to see right before our predator in the movie activates the bomb with the that he sort of calls into the jungle. Now, in terms of insect mandibles, I mean, we don't really have anything once we start getting larger into the big mammals that possess, or even like the big lizards, these sort of extendable mandibles attached to their face.
It's very much an arthropod characteristic, your spiders, your insects, your lobsters, crabs, that kind of thing.
But just because it doesn't show up on Earth doesn't mean it couldn't show up somewhere else.
Mm-hmm.
And I mean, we do have animals that have second sets of jaws. We've talked about the eels before and what are called pharyngeal jaws. That second set of jaws contained within an animal's throat or pharynx that kind of pops out to sort of chunk food. So once they bit onto something, they have something else that they can sort of chew with. The other theory that I found that I really enjoyed is a couple of ecologists and physiologists who've taken a crack at this have just suggested that the jaws are probably vestigial, that they may have served a previous purpose, but as this species has evolved and become more like us, they've fallen into the same category as the appendix. So vestigial organs are organs that are a remnant of something that used to serve function but really doesn't anymore, but it's just been carried along through generations because it really doesn't have a negative effect most of the time. And the suggestion has just been, they probably eat normally now. I mean, they've got knives and tools and other things. They're probably just chopping it up and tossing it into their mouth, but they've got these hangover jaws from previous generations.
They might. I think the only problem with that is that an exterior characteristic like that, an exterior trait like those big jaws on the outside of its face, are likely going to have some kind of selection pressure associated with them. Mm. Whenever you have these vestigial organs, to my knowledge, they're usually an internal organ that doesn't really interact with the environment too much anymore. So I don't know if it's all whales, but I know of at least one whale species where if you look at its skeleton, it still has rear legs attached to its spine inside of the body itself, because they're in the body now. They're no longer being selected against by, you know, it's already hydrodynamics. There's no real pressure for that genetics to change. So those flippers on the inside of the body don't move anymore. Or aren't, like, being worn away. But this probably is still used somehow to eat. And I think that plays into my idea of, like, why these guys are such good jumpers. But that's for when we get to that.
Do you also think they could have just kept it because it is used for expression and communication?
Potentially. It could also be a sexually selected trait.
Ooh.
I think we talked on in a previous episode with the deer forest spirit in Princess Mononoke. But if... at least from the books, the Yautja are a matriarchal society where they have, quote, breeding seasons, and the female will pick the most fit male. And it could be that the bigger and sexier looking the mandibles, the more likely a female is to choose that male.
Or maybe the smaller the mandibles, the more likely.
This is also
true. You don't
know.
You know what they say about a creature with detachable jaws. I don't know what they say.
What do they say?
What do they say, Dave?
What do they say, Dave?
I feel like we'd have to interrogate a furry for an answer to that.
And we're not doing that.
Yeah, and then in terms of other like quick physiology topics, obviously the green blood is fucking cool. We already talked about before, it's a decision that was made to basically break glow sticks and stick them out. In the sort of comic book lore as well as the movies, the blood has that luminescent green color. It has the capacity to neutralize the acidity of the xenomorph blood.
Does it?
Yeah, apparently it's seen, as well as it has the ability to bestow significant life-giving properties on humans, capable of extending a person's lifespan. Obviously, none of that is covered in the movie that we're talking about. And talking about green-colored blood, there's really not a lot of examples on the planet, but the primary one that gets brought up all the time is characteristic of a group of lizards in New Guinea. So the green-blooded skinks are a type of lizard. The muscles, bones, and tongues of these animals appear bright lime green due to high levels of a compound called biliverdin. So it's a green bile pigment. It's toxic in most animals and triggers jaundice. However, surprisingly, these lizards remain healthy with levels of this green bile in their blood 40 times higher than what the lethal concentration would be in humans. Now, there's been a whole bunch of research to try and figure this out, because there was a discussion for a while of maybe they were getting it from something that they were eating. They were consuming a toxic plant, so it was getting brought in. Maybe this was some sort of other weird byproduct. But there's actually been some cool PCR DNA work that showed that they actually likely shared a red-blooded ancestor, so that they made a transition from the traditional red hemoglobin-associated compounds over to increasing the biliverdin. And one of the top theories as to why this might have happened, which I thought would make Adam really, really happy, would be because something was predating them, potentially from a parasitic perspective. If there's something that was getting into their blood and potentially affecting them, if they increase these levels to basically smoke out whatever the creature is by making their own blood toxic, that is fucking badass.
I think that really works well from the point of view of this blood not only being able to neutralize the xenomorph blood, that very acidic, so this blood would have to be pretty basic in composition, but basic in the basic to acidic scale, not basic in the white girl's Instagram scale. But when you have, if it's able to, quote, extend the lifespan of humans and really kind of get around this xenomorph blood, I think that just points to this being just a very, very, very potent and strong immune system, with a lot of either white blood cells or their, you know, the Yautja equivalent of that to fight off infection, which plays into the ecology and the evolution of these creatures that I've imagined for this. But Sam likes to bring up, he hasn't done it in a little while, but he brings up examples of crocodile blood or alligator blood. I can't remember which species it is, but they have an incredibly strong immune system because they live in swamps, and any kind of incision on your body is going to be very quickly filled with any kind of infective agent. And by having a strong immune system, you can kind of survive when those kind of things happen. So you put a drop of, as Sam puts it, golden staff into the crocodile blood, and it kills it like that. So
yeah, that's something I never thought about, was like, what happens when you have a creature that lives in this filthy environment and they have an injury? It's interesting.
Mm-hmm. And then there's one last point that I wanted to talk about before I get to the big one to discuss for this podcast, which was doing a lot of reading on this. Holy shit, there's a lot of variation that takes place between the predators. And there's been a whole bunch of movie and sci-fi people that have pointed out, so as well as those fleshy dreadlocks that are located on the sides of the predator's head, some seem to possess quills on their cheeks, some above the eye, some further down. Their physical appearance includes a number of subtle variations akin to human genetic diversity. So they have variations in height, they have variations in skin color, variations in hairline, as well as sort of there are differences between the genders, which I wasn't aware of, but apparently the comics do get into the fact that they are a dual-sexed species. That's just so cool. I'd never thought about the fact, and I don't know if this is something you guys have considered, that yeah, a lot of the time when we see our monster movies, all the xenomorphs look the same.
Yep.
All of the Tomorrow Monster monsters other than the queen look exactly alike. But the hyenas that are chasing me can look different. The lion pack that's chasing me, those animals look different. But that's really cool. I don't know. And this was, I guess, something I really wanted a story perspective on in terms of this really enhanced, I think, my enjoyment of the film when I thought about it. And I was like, but that must be fucking hard to do, to have costume designers working on multiple models to try and make them look cool.
I think that would be easier. When you have something that you're trying to replicate so perfectly, it's easier just to have that ability to have variation within it. So then you have that creative freedom of like, fuck it, I'm going to stick some quills here. Like, yep. You know, or hiring actors that are not 7'2". So you can have that size diversity, and it makes sense narratively. I think that that's for me, obviously I'm not a makeup designer, so maybe that is harder, but it seems like it would be.
Do you feel like CGI monsters might limit this then? If it's just easier to make a model and render it over and over and over again looking the same? If we're talking about costume designers, an individual person coming in and making the different outfits, as opposed to Libby sits down in front of her computer, builds a CGI model, and then it's just like, I'm going to have 100 of these attack at him.
Good
yeah,
luck.
So I think it's easier from that perspective, too, to have variety, because that's what, from my understanding, CGI artists run into that problem of if they use the same model and have them do all the same thing, it looks incredibly fake. So they have to go in, even if it's the same. So this is kind of classic in big war scenes, like Lord of the Rings, for example, when they're adding the armies in behind. They actually built a system in which it alters what each individual soldier is doing so they don't all look the same.
Oh, cool.
Yeah, so I think it would be easier in the sense of having all these different, if you use CGI, different looking ones so they don't look as fake.
Hmm.
You know, our eyes are used to seeing variety, so it would make sense to naturally think that the variety on film would be more realistic.
The last quick point I wanted to talk on for the physiology, mainly just because I got the reactions I was hoping from Libby and Adam yesterday discussing this. Holy shit, the predators jump. I had not realized that until I was watching it. Fucker jumps from tree to tree to tree, and then he's jumping down huge distances from the tree to land without, you know, sort of superhero landing. Doesn't do any damage or anything like that. And then he's off again, jumping again up into these trees.
He really reminded me of a squirrel the whole time.
Yep.
Because he kept going like up and then down and then just like jumping around.
Yeah. And you guys, I think, have some interesting points to flow on this that I want to get into. But the first thing that was just popping up is these guys jump 3 times their own height. They've had people measure it, and they seem to be capable of falling up to 10 times their height in certain other, you know, later movies. Now, in the animal kingdom, the highest jumping terrestrial animal is the cougar, which I was like, okay, like, what does the cougar jump? Fucking cougars can jump 6 meters. They can jump up. Which is nuts. Apparently, they've been known to get like cats and dogs that people have left on like their second story balcony, and the cougar just jumps up, and they're like, "Thank you for leaving me a snack," and then
they
jump back down.
Determined housewife, right there.
In terms of the broadest jumping animal, though, the one that can sort of jump the greatest distance, it's the gray kangaroo that is capable of jumping from point to point 13.5 meters.
Wow.
That is insane.
That's insane. Now, obviously, when we get into the insect kingdom, the meadow frog hopper takes the world's record for jumping 400 times higher than its own body length.
Fleas are really good, too.
Right. But these things, as we've talked about before, insects play by very different rules than what we play by.
They do.
Just as a quick summary, because I think we've briefly talked about this before, but kangaroos, the way that they're able to hop and achieve these huge distances is that when they hop and their legs compress, bringing the toes towards the body, it functions like a spring being compressed. We're not going to get into the differences between sort of stored potential energy, mainly just because I suck at it. Physics was always my worst subject. But if they're storing energy in such a way that basically they're storing it primarily from the getting the bounce from the Achilles tendon, then when they jump and they've got all that stored energy, they're capable of acting almost like a rubber band. The legs compress, the tendon gets stretched, the energy is stored in the tendon, referred to as elastic potential energy. And then when they start to jump, moving themselves forward, they're able to release that energy and spring themselves potentially saving an estimated 40% energy that other four-legged animals would need to use to try and make a comparable jump.
Yeah, and I think that one of the cool things about, I don't know if it's the kangaroo or the wallaby or a specific species of one of the two, but because of this elastic potential and the way they store that energy in their legs, they can theoretically hop forever because it doesn't take nearly as much energy as it would. It basically recycles the energy, kind of like regenerative braking in a vehicle.
Right. So I could totally see our predator having some jump, but man, he's going to be someone who does not skip leg day. He is going to be fitting himself into those pants skin tight to try and make these jumps. That, or he's just going to be bottomless the entire time, just hanging it all out.
I mean, maybe the predator comes from, maybe their planet has a stronger gravity than ours does. So what would be a, quote, normal, you know, jump on their planet would be insane here. I mean, look at the astronauts on the moon whenever they go, and they can do some pretty wild jumps.
Yeah. You had some thoughts on their climbing, Adam.
I did. So the predator is, in the movie, we see them, him being very arboreal, flying through the trees, no problem, moving around as easily in the trees as he does on the ground, if not easier. And I think this plays into the ecology and evolution of this species. So you have, they've got claws on their hands and on their toes, their toenails, like, it's like finger and toenails, but they're like spiky and strong enough that when the predator is fighting Arnold at the end, he goes to rake him with the claws and he misses, but he hits a rock and sparks fly.
Oh, right.
So these are very strong. And in, I think it's Predator 2, we see the predator punch through concrete. So very strong, able to break through these hard surfaces. I think the predators evolved their planet is meant to be arid, very desert-like. And so that's why they come to Earth when it's very, very hot. But I think they're evolving in an environment like the Grand Canyon or where we're going to be living, the Negev Desert, where there's a lot of cliffs, a lot of sheer rock faces. And this species is basically a species of rock climbers. They're the best climbers there's ever been. Alex Honnold's got nothing on them. And they have this crazy musculature, this crazy jumping ability, and this ability to climb up, down, sideways, what have you, with no problem, because that is how they've had to hunt their prey, which could be an equivalent to the mountain goats we have here. If you've never seen a picture of mountain goats on the Hoover Dam licking salt, look it up. It is horrifying. These species can put their entire goat body on a small point the size of an eraser on a pencil. Incredible balance, incredible strength, and I think the predators would have evolved to hunt something like that. So those mandibles would have been really handy if it's a smaller creature, maybe. And they need to use their hands and their feet to hang onto the wall. But their mandibles can grab onto their prey, and their mouth can then eat it while their mandibles hold it.
Mm. Ooh, cool. I like that.
Then, as a rock climber myself, I can tell you get a lot of scrapes and cuts on your hands and whatever. Or underneath your chin. If you fall down a rock and your face scrapes it all the whole way down. That happened. True story. A week and a half ago. So, flying around on a cliffside or on a sheer rock face and getting all these little cuts is a really good way to get an infection. So having an incredibly strong immune system could have been built off of that pretty well.
Cool.
If they are coming from a desert planet that is hotter than ours, it's going to be incredibly hot during the day. So they're probably adapted to be hunting at night because the predator we see has a lot of pale skin, which would not make sense evolutionarily in living in a hot, sun-drenched desert environment and hunting during the day.
Makes sense.
So I think that's where the thermal vision would have evolved. Because much like pit vipers here on Earth, they'd use their thermal vision to help them hunt at night to be able to see the warmer temperature of the body of their prey standing out from the lower ambient temperature around them. I think that their thermal vision would have then evolved to help them hunt on these cliffside, you know, rocky environments to find whatever they're trying to hunt standing out against that background.
So would that make them nocturnal then?
I would think so.
So what, cool. During the day, do you think they're just like hanging out in a cave, or like how do you think they're escaping the daytime?
A nice lazy boy lounging somewhere.
In a cave, there'd be a lazy boy. They might bury themselves in sand.
I was about to say, I like to think of him doing like a big sand angel and just covering himself.
I think that works.
My backup was going to be hammocks.
Banana hammocks? That's what they'd be wearing when they do this. Got him. But yeah, I think these are going to be nocturnal cliff/rock climbing species, and that's why they're so good. Possibility, I don't know physiologically if it's going to work very well, but squirrels here, they have their ability to turn, they turn their feet around in the back, or if they just are facing backwards. But that's what makes them so good at climbing forwards and backwards up and down a tree. but we see in the movie that the Predator, whenever Arnold's hiding from it right before the final climax, it climbs face first down the tree right mm-hmm. beside him, and it does it very slowly, very easily, very quietly.
Yeah.
So maybe using its, you know, toe claws, it's able to rotate its feet 180 degrees to face backwards, like we can do with our hands and our wrists, allowing it to get either better purchase or maybe sink its toes into the tree like pythons on a, like toe spikes on boots when people go ice climbing.
Or cool. to have that unique reverse grip whenever it's doing its deadlifts.
It'd be helpful for that, I think.
In the really forest, the away from all the others so that no one sees it working out, so they just all think exactly. that it's naturally just this buff. It's
the natural body.
Exactly. Exactly.
Now, the ecology point that I'm most interested in having a discussion with Adam about and is just killing for sport, right? The whole main purpose, the subject behind the Predator. There are a lot of species on Earth that do this, that basically hunt for pleasure or hunt for sport, right, Adam?
There are. Many of them are known to be absolute assholes and terrible creatures. Dolphins, they're not cute, they're not cuddly, they're horrible, rapey, murdery creatures that kill for fun. Otters, I don't know if it's all otters or just sea otters, but otters are also known to kill for fun and have their horrendous sexual ways with the corpses of the things they kill. Humans, obviously.
Leopards, hyenas.
House cats.
House cats.
Keep your cats inside. Got it.
Keep your fucking cats inside.
And when we say kill for fun, you mean not killing to eat.
Correct.
Right.
So you're killing something and then just leaving it there.
Yep.
So, I mean, it does happen. Have we looked at evolutionary reasons why animals might learn to do something where they're not consuming foodstuffs? Is this just a mark of intelligence that the smarter you get, the more you suck?
I mean, it could be something along those lines. I don't study animal behavior, so I hesitate to make too many claims on that or put forth too many hypotheses. But I'm guessing it comes from the point of view of a lot of these animals that seem to do this have a very developed societal or cultural within their own species hierarchy. And they engage in play, they engage in fake hunting. So I think this is just the pinnacle of fake hunting for them, where they're, you know, I'm keeping my skills sharp, I'm doing this because I can, and because it's fun, maybe.
Yeah, I think I've read somewhere, too, that it does have to do with, like Dave was suggesting, a marker of intelligence, in the sense of it is, they use it for entertainment. So they're developed enough to where they have, essentially, free time, like boredom time. Mm-hmm. So they use that downtime to entertain themselves, which would be killing.
Yep.
Back in 1997, a group of dead porpoises washed up on the coast of Scotland and in Virginia as well. When biologists studied the bodies, it was revealed that the porpoises had died of broken ribs, ruptured livers, punctured lungs, and there were bruises all along their body. When they were lined up and checked, the bite marks as well as the trauma was consistent with damage done from bottlenose dolphins. The weirdest thing about this whole thing, porpoises do not attack, harm, or generally mess with dolphins.
So their deaths literally had no porpoise. Bloody, bloody.
So bad. Don't you dare.
I got you, Sam.
Got new tires on my mic, mate, chuffed.
The last sort of quick thing before we let Libby take us away with her story ideas. Adam, there is a problem we run into whenever we discuss creatures like the Predator with a shit ton of technology and with culture, right?
Yeah, it's one of those hard things where what about their behavior or about what they're doing in the movie is related to them as a species or related to them as a sentient, sapient, and technologically advanced society?
Mm-hmm.
The Predator we see in the movie comes from space off of a spaceship doing a quick flyby on Earth. It has weapons that are beyond the scope of human technology to this day, you know, 20, 30, 4 years in the future. You have to be careful whenever we dissect the science of this, because what about this is inherent and biological, and what about this is an advanced technological thing? I think the only thing to touch on there is maybe it's thermal vision. Because the vision we see in the movie is mainly from its helmet, its face covering that seems to be somehow toning down,
dampening,
and attenuating their own thermal vision. Because when it takes it off towards the end, when it's fighting Arnold, everything just goes red. It's much, much more washed out. It's hard to see anything. So that, I think, can play into, you know, their own ecology and their own evolution, where they're hunting for a prey species that is maybe in some kind of arms race to adapt and be able to blend in thermally to its environment. Because if you have a species like a predator that's really good at seeing any kind of heat, and you need to really be able to match the ambient temperature of your surroundings to be able to blend in so you don't see. So I think that as a result of that evolutionary arms race, it's the vision that becomes so sensitive to temperature that when it gets to Earth in the jungle, even at night when it's fighting Arnold, all that heat from the day is just radiating off of these plants. Mm-hmm. So it takes off its helmet and there's just heat everywhere. Everything's red. It's all about as hot as Arnold is. And Arnold's pretty hot.
Just had to throw that in there.
That, I think, is... You just have to be... It's a really fine line to walk. Not as hot as Carl Weathers.
Who's he?
His name is Carl Weathers, and he's my new acting teacher. And Lindsay, he's teaching me all these valuable life lessons.
I buy all my cars at police auction.
On the note of hot characters and hot scripts, Libby, you had some story ideas for this week.
Well, yeah, I just wanted to... I think bouncing off 2 weeks ago when we covered Suicide Squad, it got me thinking about cinematic universes. And I think I wanted to touch on how the Predator-Alien universe... Is there a name for that, by the way? Other than
knowledge.
Predator-Alien universe?
No, not that I know.
Me neither. For me, I think that it is a unique universe because they are different tones of movies. And what I mean by that is when you watch a, and I'm going to pick on Marvel, because DC for life, even though their movies suck, when you watch a Marvel movie, you know you're watching a Marvel movie, right? It's the same formula, it's quippy, one-liners, and then big, long action sequences, lots of, you know, bright, flashy colors, that kind of stuff. Like, everything feels the same. Yet if you watch Alien and then if you watch Predator, same universe, two entirely different movies, as I mentioned in the beginning. You know, you have this space horror, you know, cosmic horror almost, where things are dark and, you know, lots of fluids, and it's just very, very, different feeling than this action Rambo in the jungle fighting a dreadlocked alien. And I think that that's really fascinating, and I wish that more cinematic universes could do that, is treat movies separately and not necessarily just try to mimic the same tone of the script or cinematography or, you know, visuals throughout, because I think that that's a missed opportunity. You know, you see Star Wars movies are all the same for the most part, and I think the other... Conjuring is a universe as well, you know. So I think it's a really cool idea of taking a universe and not necessarily sticking to the tried and true, like they all need to be this cookie cutter formula in order for them to be in the universe. Like, clearly we see this works. There's a huge fan base for Alien and Predator. Alien is a fantastic movie. No one's arguing that. Predator is a fantastic movie. No one's arguing that. And they're very different from each other, and that's okay.
Even within the Alien universe itself, you've got Alien, horror movie, Aliens, action movie.
That's it, man. Game over, man. It's game over. What the fuck are we gonna do now?
Okay, so that kind of wraps up my story points, but I did have a fun question for Dave. I did pose this to Adam already, so he answered. So this is,
and I answered correctly, Dave.
All on you,
shit.
Dave.
Oh, shit.
Okay, here's my fun question. Speaking of Alien versus Predator, if you were to take Ripley and trade places with Dutch, so Dutch would be in the Alien movie and Ripley would be in Predator, who, or if any, do you think would survive?
Do they get to keep their weapons, and do they have knowledge of the situation they're dropped in? Like, does Dutch just wake up and he's on a spaceship and has no idea, or does he wake up with, like, Ripley's memories?
No, so they're still their own characters. So Dutch would be a trained armed forces. But, you know, for whatever reason, he's in space. It's not like you got teleported up there and you don't know where you are. So he knows, like, he's on this ship, but obviously, just like Ripley, does not know what these aliens are. And just like him in the jungle, Ripley has no idea that there's this predator in the jungle. She just happens to be this space... What is her profession? She's a
long-haul trucker.
Long-haul trucker, yeah. She's just in the Guatemalan jungle.
I'm worried they're both going to do better, actually, in these respective movies, because we know that Ripley loves her flamethrower, And there's nothing that's going to piss off the Predator more than just more heat.
That's true.
That's Aliens. That's not Alien. That's the second movie where she's with the Marines.
Well, she has the flamethrower in the first one. They have the flamethrowers.
They do. I don't know if she uses them. Dallas does, and he gets gotten in the ducks.
I just see her circling the area of the jungle that the Predator's in and just lighting it on fire and being like, I'm done with this. Everything will be fine. This will work itself out. In terms of Dutch in a spaceship, I mean, like, I feel like Arnold would be smart enough to just kill the fucker when it's small, which is what I scream at the movie every time I watch that beloved film. It's like when it jumps out of the chest, I just see Arnold, like, gripping it in his hands as it, like, bites into him as he squeezes the life out of it. And it was like, well, that was a short film.
So you think they'd both survive?
I think they'd both do better.
Adam, what did you say?
I said that I think Dutch will be fine because he is a trained soldier with a knowledge of a lot of stuff. He is a survivalist. We see him jerry-rig an entire death zone and trap field for the Predator to fight at the very end. He did very well against a very superior opponent. And I think that with a crew under him, he would use his leadership skills and his charisma to be able to tell them what to do. He would have never let Ash back on the ship anyway, infected with whatever it was. So movie's over right there. If it came down to it, he'd be able to organize the crew into doing what he wanted to do using military tactics and his knowledge of using whatever he has around him to then make the situation better for him. I think Ripley's fucked. She is a trucker. She is just an employee who's doing a job, moving stuff from one part of space to another. She's put in the jungle. She has no special forces training. She has no weapons training. She has no survivalist training. And, I mean, she might survive from the point of view of if she doesn't have any weapons, she's not a threat and not a worthy kill for the Predator. So that could work. And as we see in the movies, the Predator usually just goes for men. It tends to ignore women, even if they have a gun, especially the one who's pregnant in the second movie. But I think that she's screwed and Arnold's fine. And, sorry, Dutch, not Arnold. Sigourney Weaver would obviously survive. Ripley, probably not.
And Libby, did you have thoughts on this comparison?
My only thing was, I think if Dutch got himself into a situation where he had to escape through these, like, small space, you know, ship cracks and crevices, his just big, bulky body, he would get stuck and just be absolutely fucked.
I'm seeing one of two scenarios, which is either just, like, Dutch's legs, like, hanging out of the vent as, like, the alien comes along and is like, oh, is this even worth it? Or, which is even better, the alien looks up at the vents and you just see, like, the metal, like, parting in those squares as he's, like, moving through it. And you just hear him and he's like, oh, there is silent.
Yeah. Or, like, when he's shimming through, like, some, like, pipes and stuff and he's just like, oh, and the pipes like, kung, kung, kung.
I'm just imagining an Arnold-sized hole in the wall as he's running from it. Just a perfect like outline of him, his big baby biceps going straight through the wall.
You have no respect for logic.
Okay. But he's got an axe!
And I have no respect for those with no respect for logic. You're a very stupid person.
So, I think that's everything for all of us for today.
Yeah, what are we doing next week?
Next week, I'm using my executive power as one of the hosts to see a blank spot on the schedule and say that we're doing Little Shop of Horrors next week.
Yeah.
Finally. 1974? 73? Rick Moranis, Steve Martin.
And one very hungry plant.
Very hungry plant. Named Audrey, too. I love this movie. It's so great. I'm really excited about this.
My partner has never seen this before. And
neither has
me either.
Ooh, I'm excited to share.
So excited. Next week? Little Shop of Horrors. And remember, as we say here at the end of every episode, the monsters aren't real, but the science is.
Now say that like Arnold.
The monsters aren't real, but the science is.
Bye, guys.
Bye.
It kills for pleasure.
He was skinned alive.
It hunts for sport.
He's killing us one at a time.
We're all going to die.
But this time, it's picked the wrong man to hunt.
If it bleeds, we can kill it.
Ah! 20th Century Fox presents Arnold Schwarzenegger. Predator.